Good sense permits us not to rejoice with Nilfgaard pushing northwards, hard and liable any day to seize Novigrad. For from Novigrad everything, including our neutrality, looks different than from the distant south. Thus, it would be good if Redania and Temeria were to hold back Nilfgaard's advance in order to push the invader back across the Yaruga. But would it be good were it done using our money? Are you listening to me, my most beloved wife?
I am, husband.
And what do you think?
All wisdom is contained in the good book.
But does your good book say what to do if some Dykstra shows up and demands a million from you?
The book, Zuleika blinked from over her spectacles, says nothing about base mammon, but in one passage it says, to give is a greater happiness than to receive, and supporting a pauper with alms is noble. It is said, give away all, and it shall make your soul noble.
And makes the purse and breadbasket empty, Esterad Tyson muttered. Zuleika, is any wisdom to be found in the book concerning business, apart from passages about noble free distribution and almsgiving? What does the book, for instance, say about equivalent exchange?
The Queen straightened her spectacles and began to quickly turn over the pages of the Incunabulum.
Measure for measure, she read.
Esterad was silent for a long while.
And perhaps, he finally drawled, something more?
Zuleika returned to turning the pages of the book.
I have found, she suddenly announced, something amongst the wisdom of the prophet Lebioda. Should I read it?
If you would.
The prophet Lebioda. In sooth, support the pauper with alms, but rather than give the pauper an entire watermelon, give him half a watermelon, for a pauper is liable to lose his wits from happiness.
Half a watermelon? Esterad Tyson bristled. You mean half a million byzants? And you know, Zuleika, that to have half a million and not to have half a million is a whole million together.
You didn't let me finish.
Zuleika scolded her husband with a harsh look over her spectacles.
The prophet goes on. Better even is to give the pauper quarter of a watermelon. And it is even better to cause that some else give the pauper a watermelon. For in sooth, I tell you, there will always be someone who has a watermelon and is inclined to share it with the pauper, if not out of nobleness, then out of calculation or on some other pretext.
Ha!
The King of Covia thumped his scepter down on the bedside table.
In sooth, the prophet Lebioda was shrewd. Instead of giving, cause someone else to give. That appeals to me. Those are in sooth flowing words. Study the wisdom of that prophet, my darling Zuleika. I'm certain you will discover among it something that permits me to solve the problem of Redania and the army that Redania wishes to raise using my money.
Zuleika leafed through the book for a long time before she finally began to read.
A pupil of the prophet Lebioda once spake to him. Teach me, master, how I am to act, for my neighbour is desirous of my favourite dog. If I give him my pet, my heart will break from sorrow. If, though, I do not give it, I shall be downhearted, for I shall pain my neighbour through my refusal. What to do? Do you have, asked the prophet, something you love less than your pet dog? I have, master, the pupil replied, an impish cat. A tiresome pest, and I love him not at all. And thus spake the prophet Lebioda. Take that impish cat, that tiresome pest, and give it to your neighbour. Then you will know happiness. You will be rid of the cat, and will delight your neighbour. For most often it is so, that our neighbour does not desire a gift, but to be given.
Esterad was silent for some time, and his brow was knitted.
Zuleika, he finally asked, was that really the same prophet?
Take that impish cat.
I heard it the first time, the king yelled, but immediately restrained himself. Forgive me, most beloved.
The point is, I don't understand what cats have to do with...
He fell silent. and pondered deeply. After 85 years, when the situation had changed enough to allow talk about certain issues and persons, Guiscard Vemuelen, Duke of Creighton, grandson of Estrad Tyson and son of his oldest daughter, Gaudemunda, spoke. Duke Guiscard was then a venerable old man, but he clearly remembered the events he had witnessed. It was Duke Guiscard who revealed where the million Byzants came from, the million with which Redania equipped its cavalry for the war against Nilfgaard. That million didn't come, as had been thought, from Covier's treasury, but from the Hierarch of Novigrad. Estrad Tyson, Guiscard disclosed, obtained the Novigradian money from his shares in the maritime trade companies being set up. The paradox was that those companies were set up with the active cooperation of Nilfgaardian merchants. Thus it appeared that Nilfgaard itself, to some degree, had financed the fielding of the Redanian army.
Grandpapa, Guiscard Vemuelen recalled, said something about watermelons, smiling roguishly. He said somebody always wants to give to a pauper, even if out of calculation. He also said that since Nilfgaard itself was contributing to increasing the strength and military capabilities of the Redanian army, they couldn't blame others for doing the same. Later, though, the old man went on, Grandpapa summoned my father, who was at that time the chief of intelligence and the minister of internal affairs. When they learned what orders they were to execute, they fell into a panic. They were concerned about releasing more than 3,000 people from prisons, internment camps, and exile. House arrest was to be withdrawn from more than 100. No, it didn't only apply to bandits, common criminals, and hired mercenaries. The pardons were mostly for dissidents. Among the pardoned were henchmen of the deposed King Reed and people of the usurper Edie, their virulent partisans. And not only those who had supported in word. Most were in prison for sabotage, assassination attempts, and armed revolts. The Minister of Internal Affairs was horrified, and Papa extremely worried. While Grandpapa, the Duke went on, was laughing as though it were a first-rate joke. And then he continued, I remember every word. It's a great pity, gentlemen, that you don't read the good book before going to sleep. If you did, you would understand the ideas of your monarch. As it is, you'll be carrying out orders without understanding them. But don't worry, your monarch knows what he's doing. Now, go and release all my impish cats, those tiresome pests. That's just what he said, impish cats, pests. And he meant, which no one then could have known, subsequent heroes, commanders covered in glory and fame. Those cats of Grandpapa's became the celebrated condottieri, Adam Adieu Pangrat, Lorenzo Mola, Juan Frontino Gutierrez, and Julia Abatamarco, who became famous in Redania as Pretty Kitty. You youngsters won't remember it, but when I was a boy, when we played at war, every lad wanted to be Adieu Pangrat, and every girl Julia Pretty Kitty. But to Grandpapa, they were mischievous cats. Later, though, mumbled Guiscard Vemuelen, Grandpapa took me by the hand and led me out onto the terrace, where Grandmama Zuleika was feeding the seagulls. Grandpapa said to her,
The old man slowly, and with great effort, tried to recall the words which, 85 years ago, King Estrad Tyson had said to his wife, Queen Zuleika, on the terrace of Ensenada Palace, towering over the Great Canal.
Do you know, my most beloved wife, that I have spotted one more piece of wisdom among the words of the prophet Lebioda? One that shows me yet another benefit of giving Redania those mischievous cats. Cats, my Zuleika, come home. Cats always come home. Well, and when my cats return, when they bring their pay, their spoils, their riches, I shall tax them.
When King Esterhard Tyson spoke to Dijkstra for the last time, it was in private, without even Zuleika. Admittedly, a more or less 10-year-old boy was playing on the floor of the gigantic chamber, but he didn't count, and furthermore was so busy with his lead soldiers that he paid no attention to the two men talking.
"That is Guiscard," Esterhard explained, nodding towards the boy. "My grandson, the son of Gaudimunda and that ne'er-do-well Prince Vermuelen. But that little boy is Covier's only hope, should Tancred Tyson turn out to be... should anything happen to Tancred."
Dijkstra was aware of Covier's problem, and Esterhard's personal problem. He knew that something had already happened to Tancred. The lad, if he had any makings of a king, would only be a bad one.
"Your matter," Esterhard said, "is already by and large sorted out. You may now start to ponder on the most effective way of using the 1,000,000 byzants, which will soon end up in the Redanian coffers."
He bent down and surreptitiously picked up one of Guiscard's brightly painted lead soldiers, a cavalryman with a raised broadsword.
"Take that and conceal it well. Whoever shows you another such identical soldier will be my emissary, even if he doesn't look like it, even though you have no faith that he is my man or is aware of the issue of our 1,000,000. Anyone else will be an agent provocateur."
"Redania," Dijkstra bowed, "will not forget this, Your Majesty. I, however, speaking for myself, would like to assure you of my personal gratitude."
"Do not do so. Give me that 1,000 with which you hoped to gain my minister's favour. Why, isn't the king's favour deserving of a bribe? Your Royal Highness is stooping. We are. Hand over the money, Dijkstra. To have 1,000 and not to have 1,000 adds up to 2,000, I know."
In a distant wing of Ensenada, in a chamber of much more modest size, the sorceress Sheila de Tankerville listened to the account of Queen Zuleika with concentration and earnestness.
"Excellent," she nodded. "Excellent, Your Royal Highness.
I did everything as instructed, Lady Sheila."
"Thank you for doing so. And I assure you one more time, we were acting in a good cause, for the good of the country and dynasty."
Queen Zuleika coughed softly, and her voice changed a little.
And Tancred, Lady Sheila?"
"I gave my word," Sheila de Tankerville said coldly. "I gave my word that I would reciprocate for the help with help. Your Royal Highness may sleep serenely."
"I desire that greatly," Zuleika sighed. "Greatly. While we're on the subject of sleep, the king begins to suspect something. Those dreams are amazing him, and when something amazes him, he grows suspicious."
"I shall, then, stop sending the king dreams for some time," the sorceress promised. "Returning, however, to Your Majesty's dream, I repeat, he can be confident. Prince Tancred will bid farewell to that bad company. He will not linger at the Baron of Socrates's castle, nor at Lady de Lissimore's residence, nor at the Redanian ambassador's wife's."
"He will no longer visit those personages?" "Never."
"Those personages,"
Sheila de Tankerville's dark eyes lit up with a strange glint,
"will no longer dare to trifle with Prince Tancred, for they shall be made aware of the consequences. I vouch for what I say. I vouch for the fact that Prince Tancred will take up his studies again and be a diligent scholar, a serious and level-headed young man. He shall also stop chasing skirts. He shall lose his ardour until the moment we introduce him to Cyrilla, Princess of Sintra."
"Oh, if only I could believe that."
Zuleika wrung her hands and raised her eyes.
"If only I could believe that."
"It is sometimes difficult,"
Sheila de Tankerville smiled, unexpectedly, even for herself.
To believe in the power of magic, Your Royal Highness. And actually, so it should be.
Philippa Eilhart adjusted the gossamer thin strap of her sheer nightdress and wiped the rest of the lipstick smudges from her cleavage.
Such a smart woman, thought Sheila de Tankerville with slight distaste, and she can't keep her hormones in check. May we talk?
Philippa surrounded herself with a sphere of discretion.
We can now. Everything has been sorted out in Covia, positively.
Thank you. Has Dykstra set sail?
Not yet.
Why does he delay?
He conducts long conversations with Esterad Tyson.
Sheila de Tankerville grimaced.
They've taken an uncommon liking for each other, the king and the spy.
Do you know the jokes about our weather, Dykstra? That there are only two seasons in Covia, winter and August, I do. And do you know how to tell if summer has reached Covia?
No.
How?
The rain becomes a little warmer.
Ha ha!
Joking aside, Esterad Tyson said gravely, it worries me somewhat that the winters come earlier and earlier, and last longer and longer. It was prophesied. You've read, I presume, Aethlina's prophecy. It said there that decades of unending winter will come. Some claim it's some kind of allegory, but I'm a little afraid. In Covia, we once had 4 summers of cold, rainy weather, and poor harvests. Were it not for the tremendous import of food from Nilfgaard, people would have begun to die of starvation in droves.
Can you imagine? To be honest, I can't.
Well, I can. The cooling climate may starve us all to death. Famine is a foe that is bloody hard to fight. The spy nodded, lost in thought. Dykstra?
Your Majesty?
Is there peace inside the country now?
I wouldn't say so, but I'm doing my best.
I know. Everyone's talking about it. Of the traitors on Thanev, only Vilgefortz remains alive.
After the death of Yennefer, yes.
Did you know, O King, that Yennefer met her death?
She perished on the last day of August, in mysterious circumstances, over the infamous Sedna Trench, between the Isles of Skellige and Cape Paisa de Mar.
Yennefer of Vengerberg, Esterad said slowly, was not a traitor. She was not an accomplice of Vilgefortz. If you wish, I shall supply proof.
I do not, Dykstra responded after a moment's silence. Or perhaps I will, but not right now. Now she's more convenient to me as a traitor.
I understand. Don't trust sorceresses, Dykstra. Philippa in particular.
I've never trusted her, but we must cooperate. Without us, Redania would plunge into chaos and perish.
That is true, but if I may advise you, loosen your grip a little. You know of what I speak. Scaffolds and torture chambers throughout the land, atrocities perpetrated against elves, and that dreadful fort, Drakenborg. I know you do it out of patriotism, but you are building yourself an evil legend. In it, you're a werewolf, lapping up innocent blood.
Someone has to do it.
And someone has to bear the consequences. I know you endeavour to be just, but you can't avoid mistakes, can you? For they can't be avoided. Neither can you remain clean when you're slopping around in blood. I know you've never harmed anybody for self-interest, but who will believe that? Who'll want to believe that? The day that fate turns, they'll attribute the murder of innocent people to you, and worse, claim you profited from it. And lying sticks to a fellow like tar.
I know.
They won't give you a chance to defend yourself. People like you aren't given chances. They'll tar you. But later, after the fact. Beware, Dykstra.
I shall. They won't get me.
They got your king, Vizimir, with a dagger plunged up to the guard in his flank, I heard.
It's easier to stab a king than a spy. They won't get me. They'll never get me.
And they ought not to. Do you know why, Dijkstra? For there ought to be some sort of fucking justice in this world. The day was to come when they would recall that conversation, both of them, the king and the spy. Dijkstra recalled Esterad's words in Traitorgore, as he listened closely to the steps of the assassins approaching from all directions along all the corridors of the castle. Esterad recalled Dijkstra's words on the splendid marble staircase leading from Ensenada to the Great Canal.
He could have fought back.
The misty, unseeing eyes of Guiscard Vermuelen gazed into the abyss of his recollections.
There were only three assassins, and Grandpapa was a powerful man. He could have fought, defended himself until the guards arrived. He could have simply fled. But Grandmama Zuleika was there. Grandpapa shielded and protected Zuleika. Only Zuleika. He didn't care about himself. When help finally arrived, Zuleika wasn't even grazed. Esterhad had been stabbed more than 20 times. He died 3 hours later without regaining consciousness.
Have you ever read the good book, Dijkstra?
No, Your Majesty, but I know what is written in it.
I, can you believe it, opened it at random yesterday, and I came across this sentence.
On the way to eternity, everyone will tread their own stairway, shouldering their own burden. What do you think about that?
Time I went, King Esterhad. Time to shoulder my burden.
Farewell, O spy.
Farewell, O king.
We trekked perhaps 400 furlongs southwards from the ancient and far-famed city of Asengard to a land called Kentloch. When one looks on that land from the hills, one sees numerous lakes arranged artificially in manifold dispositions. Our guide, the elf Avalach, ordered us to seek among those dispositions one calling to mind a clover leaf. And in truth, we espied one such. Moreover, it came out that there were not three but 4 lakes, for one, somewhat elongated, stretching from south to north, is, as it were, the stem of the leaf. That lake, known as Tan Mira, is ringed by a black forest. Meanwhile, the mysterious Tower of the Swallow in the elven tongue Tor Zireel was said to rise up at its northern margin. At first, nonetheless, we saw nothing save fog. I was readying myself to ask the elf Avalach about the tower when he gestured me to be silent and spoke these words. Await and hope. Hope shall return with the light and a good omen. Gaze at the endless waters. There you shall discern the envoys of good tidings. Boivid Backhuizen. Peregrinations along magic trails and places. The book is humbug from beginning to end. The ruins by Tan Mira Lake have been examined many and oft. They are not magical. Contrary to the enunciations of B. Backhuizen, they cannot thus be the remains of the legendary Tower of the Swallow. Ars Magica, 14th edition. Chapter 9.
They're coming! They're coming!
Yennefer held her wet, wind-swept hair in both hands, and stopped by the railing of the steps, getting out of the way of the women running to the wharf. Pushed by a west wind, a breaker crashed against the shore, and white plumes of foam kept gushing from clefts in the rocks.
They're coming! They're coming!
Almost the entire archipelago could be seen from the upper terraces of Caer Trolda Citadel, Ard Skellig's main stronghold. Directly ahead, beyond the strait, lay Anskellig, its southern part, low and flat, its hidden northern side, precipitous and scored by fjords. Far away to the left, tall, green, mountainous Spikerug, its peaks shrouded in cloud, broke up the waves with the sharp fangs of its reefs. To the right, Undvik Island's steep cliffs could be seen, teeming with gulls, petrels, cormorants and gannets. From behind Undvik emerged the forested cone of Hindarsfjall, the archipelago's smallest island. If, though, you were to climb to the very top of one of Kaer Trolde's towers and look southwards, you would see the solitary island of Faro, far from the others, jutting from the water like the back of a huge fish washed up at low tide. Yennefer went down to the lower terrace, stopping by a group of women whose pride and social status prevented them from rushing pell-mell to the quayside to jostle with the excited rabble. Down below, beneath them, lay the harbour town, black and shapeless, like some great marine crustacean spat out by the waves. Longship after longship sailed out of the strait between Anskellig and Spikerug. Their sails blazed white and red in the sun, and brass bosses shone on the shields suspended from their sides.
"Ringhorn is coming first," said one of the women, "followed by Fenris."
"Trilla,"
an excited speaker caught sight of another.
"Drac follows. Hafru is behind them. Angira, Tamara, Daria. No, it's Gorpina. Daria's not there. Daria's not there."
A young, heavily pregnant woman, with a thick, fair plait cradling her belly, groaned softly, paled and fainted, collapsing on the flags of the terrace like a curtain torn from its rings. Yennefer leapt forward at once, dropping to one knee, placed her fingers on the woman's abdomen, and shouted a spell to suppress the spasms and contractions, powerfully and securely binding the placenta, which was in danger of detaching, to the womb. Just to be certain, she cast another soothing and protective spell on the baby, whose kicks she could feel under her palm. She brought the woman around by slapping her face in order not to waste magical energy.
"Take her away, carefully."
"Foolish girl," said one of the old women. "A close thing."
"Hysterical. Herr Niels may still be alive. He may be on another longship."
"Thank you for your help, Madam Witch."
"Take her away," Yennefer repeated, getting to her feet. Then she stifled a curse on discovering her dress had burst at the seams when she'd knelt down. She went down to an even lower terrace. The longships were pulling into the quay one after another, and the warriors going ashore. Heavily armed, bearded berserkers from Skellige. Bandages shone white on many of them, and many had to be helped to walk by their comrades. Some had to be carried. The women of Skellige, crowded on the quayside, were looking out for their men, whooping and crying for joy if they were fortunate. If not, they fainted, or walked away, slowly, quietly, without a word of complaint. Occasionally they looked back, hoping that the white and red of Daria's sails would glint in the sound. There was no sign of Daria. Yennefer caught sight of the ruddy mane of Crachan Krait, the Jarl of Skellige, one of the last to disembark from Ringhorn's deck, towering above the other heads. The Jarl was yelling orders, giving instructions, checking, taking care of things. Two women with their eyes fixed on him, one fair and the other dark, were weeping, with joy. The Jarl, finally certain he had seen to and made sure of everything, walked over to the women, embraced them both in a bear hug and kissed them, and then raised his head and saw Yennefer. His eyes blazed, and his weather-beaten face hardened like the stone of a reef, like a brass shield boss.
"He knows," thought the sorceress. "News spreads quickly. Even while still on board ship, the Jarl found out about my being caught in a net in the sound beyond Spikerug. He knew he'd find me and Kaer Trolde. Magic, or carrier pigeons."
He walked unhurriedly towards her. He smelled of the sea, of salt, tar, and exhaustion. She looked into his bright eyes, and immediately the war cries of the berserkers, the banging of shields and the clanging of swords and battle axes resounded in her ears. The screaming of men being killed, the screaming of men jumping into the sea from the burning Daria.
"Yennefer of Vengaberg."
"Crachan Krait, Jarl of Skellige."
She bowed slightly before him. He didn't return the bow.
"Not good," she thought.
He immediately saw the bruise, a souvenir of a blow with an oar. His face hardened again, and his lips twitched, revealing his teeth for a second.
"Whoever struck you will answer for it."
"No one struck me. I tripped on the stairs."
He considered her intently, and then shrugged.
If you don't want to tell tales, that's your business. I have no time to launch an inquiry. Now listen, carefully, because these will be the only words I shall utter to you.
Very well.
Tomorrow you'll be put on a longship and shipped to Novigrad. You'll be handed over to the town authorities there, and afterwards to the Temerian or Redanian authorities, whichever comes forward first. And I know that both desire you just as ardently.
Is that everything?
Almost. Just one more clarification, which you in truth deserve. Skellige has quite often given refuge to people being hunted by the law. There is no shortage of opportunities and occasions on the Isles to atone for one's guilt through hard work, fortitude, sacrifice and blood. But not in your case, Yennefer. I shall not give you refuge. If you counted on it, then you miscalculated. I detest people like you. I detest people who stir up trouble in order to gain power, who are driven by self-interest, who plot with the enemy and betray those to whom they owe not only obedience, but also gratitude. I detest you, Yennefer. At the very moment you and your rebel comrades began inciting the rebellion on Thanith at the instigation of Nilfgaard, my longships were fighting in Atri. My boys were coming to the aid of the insurrectionists there. 300 of my boys squared up to 2,000 black cloaks. Valour and fidelity must be rewarded, just as wickedness and treachery must be punished. How am I to reward those who fell? With cenotaphs? With inscriptions carved into obelisks? No, I shall reward and honour the fallen differently. Your blood, Yennefer, will trickle between the planks of the scaffold, in exchange for their blood, which soaked into the dunes of Atri.
I'm not guilty. I didn't participate in Vilgefortz's plot.
You will present proof of that to the judges. I will not judge you.
You already have. You've even pronounced sentence.
Enough talk. I've spoken. Tomorrow at dawn, you'll sail in manacles to Novigrad to stand before the royal court, to receive a just punishment. And now, give me your word you won't try to use magic.
And if I don't?
Marquard, our sorcerer, died on Thanith. We no longer have a mage who could get you under control. But know this, you will be under the permanent observation of Skellige's finest bowman. If you so much as move a hand suspiciously, you'll be shot.
Very well, she nodded. Then I give my word.
Splendid. Thank you. Farewell, Yennefer. I shall not be escorting you tomorrow.
Krach, he turned on his heel.
Yes?
I don't have the slightest intention of boarding a ship to Novigrad. I don't have the time to prove my innocence to Dykstra. I can't risk discovering they've already fabricated proof of my guilt. I can't risk dying of a sudden cerebral hemorrhage or committing suicide in my cell in some spectacular way soon after my arrest. I can't waste time or take such a risk. Nor may I explain to you why it is so risky for me. I shan't sail to Novigrad. He gazed long at her.
You won't sail, he restated. What permits you to think like that? Is it that we once shared love's delights? Don't count on that, Yennefer. Let bygones be bygones.
I know, and I'm not counting on it. I shan't sail to Novigrad Jarl because I must go and help someone I vowed never to leave alone and helpless. And you, Krach and Krait, Jarl of Skellige, will help me in my undertaking, because you took a similar vow. 10 years ago, right here on the wharf where we stand, to the same person, to Ciri, the granddaughter of Calanthe, the lion cub of Sintra. I, Yennefer of Vengerberg, regard Ciri as my daughter, which is why I demand on her behalf that you keep your vow. Keep it, Krach and Krait, Jarl Skellige.
Really?
Krach and Krait made sure once again.
You won't even try them. None of these dainties.
Really?
The Jarl did not insist, but took a lobster from the dish, laid it on a board, and split it lengthwise with a powerful, though extremely accurate, blow with a cleaver. After sprinkling it liberally with lemon juice and garlic sauce, he began eating the flesh straight from the shell, with his fingers. Yennefer ate in a dignified manner, using a silver knife and fork, but it was a mutton chop with spinach, specially prepared for her by the astonished and probably slightly offended cook. Because the sorceress didn't want oysters, or mussels, or salmon marinated in its own juice, or gurnard and cockle soup, or stewed monkfish tail, or roast swordfish, or fried moray eel, or octopus, or crab, or lobster, or sea urchin, or, especially, fresh seaweed. She associated everything that even faintly smelled of the sea with Fringilla Vigo and Philippa Eilhart, with the insanely dangerous teleportation, the fall into the sea, the seawater she had swallowed, and the net which had been thrown over her, to which, incidentally, had been stuck seaweed and algae identical to that on the dish. Seaweed and algae smashed against her head and shoulders, along with the excruciatingly painful blows from a pine oar.
"So then,"
Krach resumed the conversation, sucking the flesh from the legs of the lobster after cracking open the joints.
"I've decided to put my faith in you, Yennefer. I'm not doing it for you, though, be aware of that. Blood, Gaius, the blood oath I gave Calanthe, does indeed tie my hands. So, if your intention to go to Ciri's aid is genuine and heartfelt, and I presume it is, I have no choice. I must help you with your scheme."
"Thank you. But rid yourself of that pompous tone, please. I repeat, I didn't take part in the plot on Thanet. Believe me."
"Is it really so important what I believe?" he flared up. "You ought rather to begin where the king is, with Dykstra, whose agents are tracking you the length and breadth of the world, with Philippa Eilhart and the sorcerers loyal to the kings, from whom, as you yourself admitted, you fled here to Skellige. You ought to present them with proof." "I have no proof,"
she interrupted, angrily stabbing her fork into a Brussels sprout the offended cook had boiled to go with the mutton chop.
"But if I had, they wouldn't let me present it. I can't explain it to you. I'm forbidden from speaking. Take my word for it, Krach. Please."
"I said, I know,"
she interrupted.
"You pledged your help. Thank you. But you still don't believe in my innocence. Believe me."
Krach threw aside the sucked out lobster's shell and drew a bowl of mussels closer. He rummaged around, rattling them, taking out the bigger ones.
"Very well,"
he finally said, wiping his hands on the tablecloth.
"I believe you, because I want to believe. But I shall not give you refuge or protection. I cannot. You may, though, leave Skellige whenever you wish, and make for wherever you wish. I'd advise haste. You came here, so to speak, on the wings of magic. Others may follow you. They can also work magic."
"I'm not looking for a refuge or a safe hideaway, Jarl. I must go and rescue Ciri."
"Ciri," he repeated, lost in thought. "The lion cub. She was a queer child."
"What?"
"Oh," he flared up again. "I expressed myself badly. Was, because she is no longer a child. That's all I meant. That's all. Cirilla, the lion cub of Sintra. She spent her summers and winters on Skellige. She was often mischievous. She was a young devil, not a lion cub. Oh, damn it, I said was a second time. Yennefer, rumours find their way here from the mainland. Some say Ciri's in Nilfgaard.
She's not in Nilfgaard.
Others that the girl is dead."
Yennefer said nothing, biting her lip.
"But I reject the second rumour," the Jarl said firmly. "Ciri's alive. I'm certain. There have been no signs. She's alive."
Yennefer raised her eyebrows, but didn't ask any questions. They were silent for a long time, listening intently to the roar of the waves crashing against the rocks of Ard Skellige.
"Yennefer," Krach said, after another moment's silence, "yet more tidings have reached us from the continent. I know that your witcher,
who hid in Brokilon after the affray on Thanedd, set off from there with the aim of reaching Nilfgaard and freeing Ciri.
I repeat, Ciri is not in Nilfgaard. I know not what my Witcher, as you choose to describe him, is planning, but he... Krach, it's no secret that I am fond of him. But I know he won't rescue Ciri. He won't achieve anything. I know him. He'll become entangled in something, get lost, start philosophizing and feeling sorrow for himself. Then he'll vent his rage, hacking whatever and whoever he can to pieces with his sword. Afterwards, to atone for it, he'll carry out some noble but senseless feat. Then finally, he'll be killed foolishly, senselessly, probably by a stab in the back. They say, Krak quickly interjected, alarmed by the sorceress's ominously changing, strangely trembling voice. They say Ciri is bound to him by destiny. I saw it myself back in Sintra, during Pavetta's betrothal. Destiny, Yennefer interrupted sharply, can be interpreted in many, many different ways. Anyway, let's not waste time on digressions. I repeat, I don't know what Geralt's plans are, or even whether he has any. I mean to get down to work myself, using my own methods, and actively, Krach, actively. I'm not accustomed to sitting and weeping, holding my head in both hands. I act.
The Jarl raised his eyebrows, but said nothing.
I shall take action, the sorceress repeated. I've already devised a plan, and you, Krach, will assist me with it, in accordance with your vow.
I'm ready, he announced firmly, for anything. The longships are moored in the harbour. Give the order, Yennefer.
She couldn't stifle a snort of laughter.
Always the same. No, Krach, no demonstrations of bravery and manliness. It won't be necessary to sail to Nilfgaard and plunge a battle axe into the lock of the city of the Golden Towers. I need less spectacular, but more tangible help. What's the state of your treasury?
I beg your pardon.
Jarl, Krach, and Krait, the help I need is expressible in cash.
It began the next day, at dawn. A frantic commotion broke out in the chambers put at Yennefer's disposal, which Seneschal Guthlaf, who had been assigned to the sorceress, was having great difficulty controlling. Yennefer was sitting at a table, almost not raising her head from various papers. She was counting, totting up columns and doing calculations, which were immediately rushed to the treasury and the island branch of Cianfianelli's bank. She was making drawings and charts, which immediately ended up in the hands of craftsmen, alchemists, goldsmiths, glaziers and jewellers. Everything went smoothly for a while, and then the problems began.
I'm sorry, my lady, Seneschal Guthlaf said slowly, but if there isn't any, there isn't any. We gave you everything we had. We can't make magic or do miracles. And I'll take the liberty of observing that what's lying before you, madam, are diamonds with a combined value of... What do I care about their combined value? She snorted. I need one, but a suitably large one. How large, Master Jeweler?
The lapidary looked again at the drawing.
In order to make that cut and those facets, a minimum of 30 carats... There's no such stone, Guthlaf stated categorically, on the whole of Skellige. That's not true, the jeweller contradicted. There is. How do you imagine this playing out, Yennefer? Krach and Krait frowned. I'm to send armed men to storm and then plunder the temple. I'm to threaten the priestesses with my wrath if they don't give up the diamond. It's out of the question. I'm not especially religious, but a temple's a temple, and priestesses are priestesses. I can only ask politely. Hint at how much it matters to me, and how great my gratitude will be. But it will still only be a request, a humble supplication.
That may be denied?
Indeed, but there's no harm in trying. What are we risking? Let's sail to Hindus Fjall together and present the supplication. I'll give the priestesses to understand what's needed. But then everything will be in your hands. Negotiate. Present your arguments. Try bribery. Pique the ambition. Appeal to higher reasons. Despair, weep, sob, beg for mercy. Call on all the sea devils. Must I teach you, Yennefer?
It'll all be for nothing, Crach. A sorceress will never reach agreement with priestesses. Certain differences of our outlook are too marked. And when it comes to permitting a sorceress to use a sacred relict or artifact... No, we'd better forget it. There's no chance.
What do you actually need that diamond for?
To build a window. I mean a telecommunicational megascope. I have to talk to several people.
Magically? At a distance?
If it was enough to climb to the top of Caer Trolder and shout loudly, I wouldn't be bothering you. The gulls and petrels, circling above the water, clamoured. The red-beaked oyster-catchers, nestling on the steep rocks and reefs of Hindersfjall, squealed shrilly, and yellow-headed gannets screeched hoarsely and gaggled. The glistening green eyes of black-crested cormorants watched attentively as the launch sailed past.
"That large rock suspended above the water," pointed out Crach and Crate, leaning on the rail, "is Caer Heimdall, Heimdall's watchtower. Heimdall is our mythical hero. Legend has it that with the coming of Tedd de Rhaedd, the time of the end, the time of white frost and the wolfish blizzard, Heimdall will face the evil powers from the land of Morhyrhyr, the phantoms, demons and spectres of chaos. He will stand on the Rainbow Bridge and blow his horn to signal that it is time to take up arms and fall into battle array for Ragnarok, the last battle, which will decide if night is to fall or dawn to break."
The launch skipped nimbly over the waves, entering the calmer waters of the bay between Heimdall's watchtower and another rock of similarly fantastic contours.
"That smaller rock is Cambi," the Jarl explained. "In Ur myths, the name Cambi is borne by a magical golden cock whose crowing will warn Heimdall of the approach of Naglfar, the hellish longboat carrying the army of darkness, the demons and phantoms of Morhyrhyr. Naglfar is built from corpses' fingernails. You wouldn't believe it, Yennefer, but there are still people on Skellige who cut the nails of the dead before burial, so as not to supply the spectres of Morhyrhyr with building materials."
"I would. I know the power of legend." The fjord protected them a little from the wind, and the sail fluttered.
"Sound the horn," Crach ordered his crew. "We're reaching the shore." "We ought to inform the pious ladies that we're paying them a visit."
The building, located at the head of a long stone staircase, looked like a gigantic hedgehog, so overgrown was it by moss, ivy and bushes. Yennefer observed that not just bushes, but even small trees were growing on the roof.
"This is the temple," Crach confirmed. "The grove surrounding it is called Hindar and is also a place of worship. It's here that people gather the sacred mistletoe, and on Skellige, as you know, people garnish and decorate everything with it, from a newborn's cradle to a grave. Have a care, the steps are slippery. The moss is almost choking religion. Let me take your arm." "As ever, that same perfume. Oh, Yena,
Crach, please. Let bygones be bygones."
"I beg your pardon. Let's go on."
Several silent young priestesses were waiting outside the temple. The Jarl greeted them courteously and expressed a wish to talk to their superior, whom he called Modrum Sigurdrifr. They went inside to a space lit by shafts of light shining from stained glass windows set high up. One of them was shining on the altar.
"By 100 sea devils," Crach and Crate muttered. "I'd forgotten how large Brisingamen was. I haven't been here since I was a child. You could probably buy all the shipyards in Sedaris with it, along with the labourers and the annual output."
The Jarl was exaggerating, but not by much. A statue of Modron Freya, the great mother, in her typical maternal aspect, a woman in flowing robes revealing her advanced state of pregnancy, which the sculptor had accented inordinately, towered above the modest marble altar, above figures of cats and falcons, above a stone basin for votive offerings. She stood with bowed head and facial features hidden by a scarf. Over the goddess's arms, which were folded on her chest, was a diamond, one element of a gold necklace. The diamond was tinged slightly blue, like the clearest water. It was large, 150 carats or so.
"It wouldn't even need cutting,"
Yennefer whispered.
"It's a rosette, exactly what I need. Facets, perfect for diffracting light."
"That means we're lucky."
"I doubt it. The priestesses will soon appear, and I, being a heathen, will be sworn at and ejected."
"Are you exaggerating?"
"Not in the slightest." "Welcome, Jarl, to the Temple of the Mother. And I welcome you too, O Honourable Yennefer of Fingerberg." Krach and Krait bowed.
"Greetings, esteemed Mother Sigurdrifer."
The priestess was tall, almost as tall as Krach, which meant she was a head taller than Yennefer. She had fair hair and pale eyes, and an oval, none too pretty and none too feminine face.
"I've seen her somewhere before," thought Yennefer. "Not so long ago." "Where?" "On the steps of Geirdroldr, leading to the harbour," the priestess recalled with a smile. "When the longboats were coming in from the Sound, I stood over you as you helped a pregnant woman who was about to miscarry. On your knees, worrying not at all about your very costly camlet dress. I saw it, and I shall never more pay heed to tales of cold-hearted and calculated sorceresses."
Yennefer coughed softly and lowered her head in a bow.
"You are standing before the altar of the Mother, Yennefer. May her grace fall on you." "Esteemed Mother, I wish humbly to ask you, say nothing. Jarl, you are no doubt very busy. Leave us alone here on Hindisfjall. We will manage to come to an agreement. We are women. It is unimportant what we are engaged in or who we are. We always serve she who is the virgin, the mother and the crone. Kneel beside me, Yennefer. Lower your head before the mother."
"Take Brisingamen from the goddess's neck," Sigurdrifa repeated. And there was more disbelief than righteous indignation in her voice.
"No, Yennefer, it is quite impossible. The point is not even that I would not dare. Even if I did, Brisingamen cannot be removed. The necklace has no clasp. It is permanently bonded to the statue."
Yennefer stayed silent for a long while, calmly eyeing up the priestess.
"Had I known," she said coldly, "I would have set sail at once for Ardskellig with the Jarl. No, no, by no means do I regard the time spent talking to you as wasted. But I have very little of it, very little indeed. Your kindness and warmth beguiled me somewhat, I confess. I am well disposed towards you," Sigurdrifa interrupted unemotionally. "I also support your plans with all my heart. I knew Ciri. I liked the child, and her fate moves me. I admire you for the determination with which you hope to go to the girl's rescue. I shall grant your every wish, but not Brisingamen, Yennefer. Not Brisingamen. Do not ask for that." "Sigurdrifa, in order to go to Ciri's rescue, I urgently need some information. Without it, I'll be helpless. I can only acquire the knowledge I need through telecommunication. In order to communicate at a distance, I must construct a magical artifact. A megascope, using magic. A device something like your notorious crystal balls. Considerably more complex. Crystal balls only permit telecommunication with another correlated crystal ball. Even the local Dwarven Bank has a crystal ball for talking to another at headquarters. A megascope has somewhat greater capabilities. But why theorize? Without the diamond, nothing will come of it anyhow. Well, I shall say farewell. Don't hurry so."
Sigurdrifa stood up and passed through the nave, stopping before the altar and the statue of Modron Freya.
"The goddess," she said, "is also the patron of soothsayers, clairvoyants, telepaths, as symbolized by her sacred animals, the cat, which sees and hears, itself unseen, and the falcon, which sees from above. And by the jewel of the goddess, Brisingamen, the necklace of clairvoyance. Why build some looking and listening device, Yennefer? Wouldn't it be simpler to ask the goddess for help?"
Yennefer stopped herself from swearing at the last moment. After all, it was a place of worship.
"The time for evening prayers is approaching," Sigurdrifa continued. "I shall devote myself to meditation along with the other priestesses. I shall ask the goddess for help for Ciri. For Ciri, who was here many times in this temple, and looked at Brisingamen around the neck of the Great Mother many times. Sacrifice one more hour or two of your precious time, Yennefer. Stay here with us for the time of worship. Support me as I pray, with your thoughts and presence. Sigurdrifa, please, do it for me and for Ciri."
The jewel, Brisingamen, on the goddess's neck. She stifled a yawn.
"Had there only been some singing," she thought. "Some incantation, some mystery. Some mystic folklore. It would have been less boring. She wouldn't be feeling so drowsy." But they were simply kneeling with bowed heads, motionless, soundless.
But they're capable, when they want to, of using the power, at times just as well as we sorceresses. It's still a mystery how they do it, without any preparations, any learning, any studies. Just prayer and meditation. Divination? Some kind of auto-hypnosis. That's what Desire de Vries claims. They absorb energy unconsciously in a trance, and they acquire the ability to transform it into something like our spells. They transform energy, treating it as a gift and favour of the Godhead. Faith gives them strength. Why have we sorceresses never succeeded with anything like that? Ought I to try? Using the atmosphere and aura of this place? I could enter a trance myself, couldn't I? If only by gazing at the diamond. Brisingamen. Intensively thinking about how marvellously it would function in my megascope. Brisingamen. Shining like the morning star. There in the gloom. In the smoke of incense and smouldering candles. Yennefer. She jerked her head up. It was dark in the temple. It smelled strongly of smoke.
Did I fall asleep? Forgive me. There's nothing to forgive. Come with me.
Outside, the night sky burned with a twinkling luminosity that changed like the colours in a kaleidoscope. The northern lights? Yennefer rubbed her eyes in amazement.
The aurora borealis? In August? How much are you capable of sacrificing, Yennefer?
I beg your pardon?
Are you prepared to sacrifice yourself, your priceless magic?
Sigurdrifa, she said with anger, don't try your sublime tricks on me. I'm 94 years old, but treat that, please, as a confessional secret. I'm only confiding in you so you'll understand I can't be treated like a child.
You didn't answer my question.
And I don't mean to, for it's the mysticism I don't accept. I fell asleep during your worship. It wearied and bored me, because I don't believe in your goddess.
Sigurdrifa turned away, and Yennefer took a very deep breath in spite of herself.
Your disbelief is not very flattering to me, said a woman with eyes filled with molten gold. But does your disbelief change anything?
All Yennefer could do was to breathe out.
The time will come, said the golden-eyed woman, when absolutely no one, including children, will believe in sorceresses. I tell you that with deliberate spite, by way of revenge. Let us leave. No,
Yennefer finally managed.
No, I won't go anywhere. Enough of this. It's an enthrallment or hypnosis, an illusion, a trance. I have developed defense mechanisms. I can dispel all this with one charm, just like that. Damn it!
The golden-eyed woman came closer. The diamond in her necklace burned like the morning star.
Your speech is slowly ceasing to serve as communication, she said. It is becoming art for art's sake. The more incomprehensible it is, the more profound and wise it is considered. In sooth, I preferred you when you could only say ugh and ooh. Come. This is an illusion, a trance. I won't go anywhere. I don't want to force you. It would be a disgrace, for you're an intelligent and proud girl. You have character.
A plain, a sea of grass, a moor, a boulder jutting from the heather like the back of a crouching predator.
You desired my jewel, Yennefer. I cannot give it to you without first making sure of a few things. I want to check what is deep inside you. Therefore, I have brought you here, to this place of power and might from time immemorial. Your priceless magic is apparently everywhere. Apparently, it's sufficient to merely hold out one's hand. Are you afraid to hold it out?
Yennefer couldn't utter a sound from her tight throat.
Ah, then, chaos, art and learning, said the woman,
whose name could not be uttered. According to you, the powers capable of changing the world?
A curse, a blessing and progress? And aren't they, by any chance, faith, love, sacrifice?
Do you hear? The cock Cambi is crowing. The waves are breaking against the shore. Waves pushed by Naglfar's prow. The horn of Hemdall sounds as he stands facing his enemies on the rainbow-coloured arch of Bifrost. The white frost is nigh. A gale and a blizzard are nigh. The earth trembles from the writhing movements of the serpent. The wolf devours the sun. The moon turns black. There is only coldness and darkness. Hatred, vengeance, and blood. Whose side will you be on, Yennefer? Will you be on the east or the west side of Bifrost? Will you be with Hemdall or against him? The cock Cambi is crowing. Decide, Yennefer. Choose. Only for this reason were you restored to life, that you might make a choice at the right moment. Light or darkness?
Good and evil. Light and darkness. Order and chaos. They are but symbols. In reality, no such polarity exists. Brightness and gloom are in each of us, a little of one and a little of the other. This conversation is pointless. Pointless. I will not come over to mysticism. To you and Sigurdrifa, the wolf is devouring the sun. To me, it's an eclipse. And may it remain that way.
Remain? What?
She felt her head spinning. Felt some horrendous force twisting her arms, wrenching the joints in her shoulders and elbows, racking her vertebrae as though she were being tortured. She screamed in pain, thrashed around and opened her eyes. No, it wasn't a dream. It couldn't be a dream. She was on a tree, hanging arms akimbo from the boughs of a gigantic ash. High above her, a falcon circled. Below her, on the ground, in the gloom, she heard the hiss of snakes, the rustling of scales rubbing against each other. Something moved beside her. A squirrel ran across her tautened and aching shoulders.
"Are you ready?" asked the squirrel. "Are you ready to offer your sacrifice? What are you prepared to sacrifice?"
"I have nothing."
The pain blinded and paralyzed her. "And even if I had, I don't believe in such a sacrifice. I don't want to suffer for millions. I don't want to suffer at all. For no one and in no one's stead."
"No one wants to suffer. But yet it is."